It's time to stand up for the students, give them the schools they need, the teachers they love, and then teach with your mouth shut. Huh? We'll explain later. Promise. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
Today's news, cash-strapped school district furloughs hundreds of non-essential children. From Erie, Pennsylvania, saying the cost-cutting measure was vital to ensure its continued operation, the cash-strapped Erie School District announced Thursday it had furloughed hundreds of non-essential children. Until the district's financial health has improved, we have no choice but to put 800 of our least necessary children on an involuntary leave of absence, said Superintendent J.D. Badhams.
Wow.
800 kids, that's a lot of kids.
800 kids are non-essential, right? We've heard the word, so we've got non-essential students. I don't know. I mean, it's Erie, Pennsylvania. God forbid. I mean, they just had 8 feet of snow.
Right.
Right? And now they don't have enough money to keep kids in school.
That happens. I mean, a lot of school districts are kind of strapped for cash.
So the cash strap, but I mean, is this the extent that we're going to now that we're actually saying that there are, quote, non-essential students? I've heard of non-essential staff do not report in the morning or certain things like that during budget cutting situations. I don't think I've ever once heard in a school setting a non-essential student.
No, they usually put the kids first.
Typically.
Or call them essential, at least. Typically. Yeah.
So.
But if you don't have money to run your school and you can't physically bring those kids in, what do? They're furloughed.
How do you determine who's a non-essential student?
Close your eyes, you spin around, and that one, and that one, and that one, and that one.
Well, you know, actually, though, I mean, they quote the superintendent again, who says, you know, we obviously hope to re-enroll these students when and if financial circumstances permit, but for now, they will remain on leave indefinitely, receiving no credits, okay? Mm-hmm. He is optimistic, though, saying that a six-year-old may, when they are 10, may be able to enter first grade without a problem, so. So here we
are.
They
could come back.
They could come back, right? You know, so maybe learning on their own. Maybe they'll learn more being furloughed than they would be being in school.
They could be essential by the time they're 10.
Maybe they'll. Hey, maybe that's it. This is crazy, right? Okay.
I don't know how long we can do this.
How long can we do this? This is obviously the onion.
Yes.
All right. There are no such things as non-essential children, although sometimes when we're in this profession, we look at some children and wish. That, however, now the reality though of cost cutting and budget cutting, this is interesting because Jay Badhams is actually a real superintendent in Erie, Pennsylvania, and was on this show and in fact was faced with a serious financial situation. And I think that's what motivated The Onion to write this piece.
So part of it's true.
Yeah. Well, what he was going to do, being faced with the fact that he did not have enough budget material, you know, not enough money.
Right.
Okay. Not enough cash. And so he just put forward the idea that, look, we're not going to open high school next year.
And, if you don't have the money, you can't open. It's a business.
He was calling the hand of the board saying, you know, if this is the amount of money, and he was calling the state of Pennsylvania saying, if this is the distribution here to pay the bills, I can only open kindergarten through eighth grade. We cannot open through high school. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these children are not going to be furloughed, but that the state's responsibility then would be to send them to neighboring school districts and take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Not non-essential, but Jay was really trying to make a point to say that, look, if you're not going to put the money, we can't run school. Gotta love The Onion, though, for spinning it in this direction to give us a different look. But no, here at Busted Pen, there are no non-essential children.
From chalkbeat.org, the Great American Teach-Off. Top Chef, Project Runway, The Voice, live competition shows have introduced audiences to the worlds of cooking, fashion, and singing, and opened a window into the intricate craftsmanship that these industries demand. Now it's time for one of America's most under-recognized professions to get the same treatment. Hi, teachers. You're on The Great Teach Off.
Oh, my.
Come on. You don't want to be on a huge stage at South by Southwest.
I was going to say, wait a minute. This is awesome, right?
Yeah.
Finally, teachers are getting the recognition they deserve.
Right.
The Voice, you know, American Idol. They're going to be out there teaching in front of people and getting judged. The question is, do we really need a reality TV show that's a competition about teaching as a one-act kind of play where you're going to be judged about essentially how much – I don't even know what. I mean, this story, while some people think this is a great breakthrough for teachers to get a focus on the craft of teaching and what they do, there are people like me who see this as very exploitative,
mm-hmm.
if that can be a word.
It is now.
Okay, it is now. And it also truly doesn't really look at teaching, and
no.
It tries to take something and make it, like as I said, a one-act play instead mm-hmm. of this long-term relationship you develop with students in trying to understand deeply certain content, certain relationships, depth of society. How is this going to promote teaching other than to promote some kind of like Robin Williams style of, you know, Dead Poets Society jumping on the desks, mm-hmm. be as crazy as you can be to get the judges to vote for you?
What I didn't understand is exactly what you said. You can't take teaching as a profession and say this is the way to do it. Because it depends on your classroom. It depends on the way you do it. And the way they describe this contest, I'm thinking Top Chef, right?
Right.
Where you go in and here's your ingredients. You have the same pans. You've got the same stove, the same Ginzu knives.
Right.
Are you ready?
Okay.
Go.
So you have the same chalk, the same desks.
Right.
The same kids. Go.
You can't do that.
I just want Chef Ramsay running around swearing at me.
Oh, yes. All the time.
You know, well,
what the beep are you doing?
You call that teaching? You're not a teacher. I mean, this is a problem. I'm going to jump on the side of those who are looking at this and saying this is making a mockery out of something that maybe there are good intentions, but you know what they say about good intentions? They pave the road to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So Great American Teach Off, good intentions. It's more like hell, you know, like Hell's Teacher, not Hell's Kitchen.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Dear legislators, why do you continue to support school-based accountability? Accountability has a 30-year record of failing children, parents, teachers, and communities. Look at the damage done by the dual disasters, No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top. These two legislatively enacted programs literally denied a generation of children access to their fundamental right of a powerful and critical education. The only beneficiaries of accountability have been you and your friends in the legislatures across the country and the companies that have made millions on the sale of tests and data systems to schools. Schools that have simultaneously been drained of money that could have gone towards the only things proven by research to help create an atmosphere in which real learning can occur: healthcare, basic nutrition, and access to books. This leads me to ask again, why? Why engage in behavior that actually damages children, families, and communities? Is the money being offered by lobbyists really worth purposely harming kids, families, and communities? If you really want to help make sure states are delivering on its promise to the children, why not simply start by asking for help from the people that actually know what they're talking about? Why not ask a classroom teacher? Hey, you know what, though? I have a better idea. Instead of school-based accountability, how about legislator accountability? You know, a simple, transparent system of accountability for you and your legislative colleagues. How about you provide us, the taxpayers, with detailed daily workloads so that we know when and where you're actually working for us? We, the taxpayers, need to be sure that all of you are not, working on administrative and other non-productive activities. We, the taxpayers, want efficient legislators. We don't really have time for you and your colleagues to engage in inefficient legislative practices. Also, It would be really helpful if you and your colleagues designed a legislative report card. We, the taxpayers, would like to know if you and your colleagues are actually building our nation's infrastructure, creating life-sustaining jobs, and helping to promote a civil society free of racism, segregation, and poverty. Right? I mean, we're paying you good money. Shouldn't we, the taxpayers, know if you and your colleagues really are effective civil servants? Or better yet, shouldn't we, the taxpayers, know who the failed legislators are? Oh, and along with that, how about a merit-based system of pay for legislators and a transparent system for the removal of failed legislators? We, the taxpayers, really don't think that you and your colleagues should have a job for life. Thanks for your time. I eagerly await a draft of a system of political and legislative accountability. Signed, Busted Pencil.
Time to explore the mind of education author and activist Alfie Cohn. This is Cohn Zone.
Alfie, the dreaded lecture. What else is there?
There's learning as opposed to listening. You know, where do we get this idea that the best way to master concepts, you know, to think more deeply and innovatively, or even just to retain information, is to sit there passively and let some instructor's words wash into us? You know, to sit and watch a traditional high school or college class is just to be struck again and again and again that this is not how human beings optimally learn. It's just a lot easier for teachers to talk at the students than to help them make sense of ideas, which requires an array of pedagogical strategies, where the talking part is one of many different ways to help that happen. You know, especially in universities, I wrote a blog post a little while ago called Don't Lecture Me, which was triggered by sitting in a classroom at a very prestigious university, listening to a very impressive scholar who's also a very has a winning way, you know, very likable, mm-hmm. Very fluent. And I just sat in the back and watched all the, first of all, I noticed that a good portion of the students hadn't even shown up for the final class session. And second, I noticed that a lot of them were on their laptops shopping for shoes or updating their Facebook pages. And then the third thing I noticed is when the teacher put up the next slide, you know, they would then copy it down verbatim and then start doing other things again. I mean, this makes no sense. Interestingly, in the hard sciences, in chemistry and physics and so on, there are universities around the country that have started to realize lectures, especially the dreaded lectures of huge introductory level classes, mm-hmm. make no sense. And so they figured out how to stop doing that to instead provide opportunities for hands-on, interactive, collaborative learning. What's really interesting about this is you would expect there would be even more need for something other than mindless listening and lecturing in the humanities and the social sciences, where there's room for open-ended exploration of ideas,
right.
Not just acquisition of a body of knowledge. And there's virtually no move toward doing that, especially at the introductory level. So we have a lot of research showing lecturing doesn't make much sense. I'm not saying never, you know.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I give lectures outside of the classroom, but I interrupt it periodically to have people turn to someone and reflect on this. I don't have the capacity to say write about this, but teachers do. So if you bring me out somewhere to talk with teachers for an hour and a half, yeah, I'll do a lot of the talking. But if I was to spend a week with a group of teachers, a lot less of it would be me talking. And if I had them for a whole term, it would be even that much less.
Well, and that's the big, I think, the big difference there when you talk about that, because if I sit in my freshman or sophomore American history class in college for 15 weeks, yeah. I'm going to be presented with 15 weeks of names, dates, and, you know, serial numbers, I guess, that will be up on the board. And
my job will be to produce that knowledge back.
That's right. And that is not a meaningful intellectual exchange. Oh. It doesn't come from that. If there's really just a bunch of facts that we want to transmit, you know, have them just read your slide deck or whatever. And really, we have this research that goes back decades showing that even in terms of mere retention of facts, sitting there listening to someone lecture, even a very talented, charismatic, amusing lecturer, is not a particularly effective way for that to happen. And it has like vanishing levels of effectiveness if your goal is more ambitious than merely transmitting facts, but actually producing stimulating thought. I mean, it basically gets back to what's your theory of learning. Cognitive scientists know that human beings actively construct meaning around ideas. They're not empty receptacles into which knowledge is poured. So as soon as you acknowledge the truth of a constructivist approach of learning, you got to shut up if you want to be a good teacher. That's one of my favorite college-level pedagogy books by a guy named Finkel called Teaching with Your Mouth Shut.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She served as principal at Southside High School in Rockville Center School District in New York. From 2000 to 2015, in 2003, she was the National Association of Secondary Schools Principals Middle Level Dissertation of the Year Award winner. In 2010, she was recognized by the School Administrators Association of New York State as the Outstanding Educator of the Year. And in 2013, she was recognized by the National Association of Secondary School Principals as the New York State High School Principal of the Year. Now, she is the executive director of the Network for Public Education. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Carol Burris.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Wow. You've been busy.
I have been busy. I have been busy. Education is absolutely my passion, and now that our three daughters are grown, I am pretty much working it 12 hours a day.
So retirement doesn't mean retirement for Carol Burris.
No. Though I will say, as hard as I'm working now, it is nothing compared to running a high school. that was definitely it was the most wonderful job in the world, but it was probably also the most stressful job in the world you could imagine, or one of the most. So now
though, the transition to the Network for Public Education, and you've been around, but let's do a small, brief history for the Busted Pencil listener. Network for Public Education, NPE, people can go to networkforpubliceducation.org, but let's just start. I mean, what is the Network for Public Education?
The Network for Public Education was founded by Diane Ravitch and Anthony Cody back in 2013. And when it was founded, they decided that there needed to be an organization out there that advocated for public education as a public good, as a pillar of democracy. There were all of these big organizations that were very, very well funded that were dedicated to questioning the need for public education. And questioning and being very critical of public education and public education's teachers. So they said, hey, we need to get together and be a countervailing force. And so it began. It began with a board of, I would say probably about 10. Many of those board members are still on the board. Mm-hmm. And then it began to grow over the years. And within the last couple of years, what's happened is it's become both a 501c3 organization as well as a 501c4 organization. The difference being both are nonprofit status, 501c3, you can give donations to and have them be a tax deduction, 501c4 not, and that is because we're allowed to do advocacy, political advocacy in the 501c4.
So, but
So you can do both the advocacy and putting things forward. But back to the origins, I remember in, was it 2011, the Save Our Schools March, where Anthony and Diane put together a small, is that kind of the germ for NPE?
I think so. I mean, I think that was, and I remember too, it was about
95 degrees in D.C. on the ellipse, and we were dying.
It was bad. I would say that probably was because a lot of the people who were the founding board members of MPE, and then even people who came on later, met on that march. Yeah, I do think that probably was the beginnings of the ideas. I was there, but I was not involved at that time.
Right. And just, you know, that was, as you said, I mean, when we think about this, at that time, the amount of money and organizations that were mounting against public education, it was almost like the Save Our Schools was this organic reaction to saying we got to do something. And now seeing NPE 5-6 years later as a solid organization that is trying to, as best we can, combat, get out the message, do whatever it is. In fact, let's move in. I mean, what's NPE up to?
Well, a lot of our focus since the appointment of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education has been pinpointed on stopping privatization, the growing privatization of public education, treating education as a commodity and students as consumers. We still are very active in opposing high-stakes testing, in supporting the opt-out movement, not evaluating teachers by test scores, and certainly social justice issues. Mm-hmm. But if there is one area where we're really concentrating a lot of our efforts, it's to stop this march of privatization that you see not only with charter schools, but also with vouchers and what many call neo-vouchers, these different schemes of tax credits and education savings accounts and changes in the 524 accounts and all kinds of ways and schemes to take public money and use it to support private schools.
Well, and that's what it is, isn't it? It's really, I mean, you sum it up. It's a move towards privatization, taking the public schools, taking the public money, and moving into a private system that, you know, decimates what we, as you said, the pillar of democracy, which is our public education system.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. If you listen to people who were very involved in it, and you have the really hardcore folks like Betsy DeVos.
I just wanted to say, in Betsy DeVos, when I looked at her endorsements, the Network for Public Education was not in the list.
No, it was not.
Okay.
when you look at what they believe in, I mean, they believe in a system that's similar to the system in Chile that was put in place by Pinochet, the right-wing dictator, in which it became a system, a very, very stratified system with elite private schools, private voucher schools that parents paid into to a certain extent and then received government money, schools that were similar to charter schools, and then also what they call the municipal schools, which is really a vestige of a public school system. And you see the socioeconomic stratification would just take your breath away. I mean, it's bad enough in the United States, but yes, you can make it worse. And believe me, the people who believe in this, they believe in a system of winners and losers. They don't really care whether schools become more segregated than they are now by class and by race. And they are trying to turn education into a product that they can put the least amount of money into, and then it becomes every kid for him or herself. And the state of Wisconsin, where you are, I mean, has in some ways been a leader in all of this, right? There are four different voucher programs.
Hey, I'm glad we're leading in something here. Yeah, right. For the listener, Busted Pencils is produced in Madison, Wisconsin, and we are at the heart. I mean, when you talk about, you had said vouchers, I mean, the earliest voucher program has their origins here in Milwaukee.
That's right.
And we've just expanded greatly. In fact, we're going to move on. And when we get back, Carol, I want to ask you specifically if you can give the listener to Busted Pencil a little bit of insight into this new part of the tax plan, this savings account that could even expand the voucher system even more. We're talking to the executive director of the Network for Public Education, Carol Burris. Carol, we left off a little bit here discussing Wisconsin and Milwaukee and vouchers and the new federal tax law and how that may actually expand vouchers and choice. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, what's happened is Wisconsin has four voucher programs, but many states do not have voucher programs because their state constitutions prohibit them. So what they've done is they've come up with all kinds of different schemes. One of those schemes is a tax credit scheme where essentially people make donations, but because it's a credit, they get all the money back. So, you know, it's not really giving at all. And then that money is put into a fund, and then that fund is then distributed for scholarships for private schools. And this gets around the Blaine Amendments that prohibit public money from going to religious schools. And in some ways, they're worse than vouchers because there are a very few guidelines in many cases in terms of curriculum. State of Arizona, for example, has another scheme called Education Savings Accounts. They're in six states where the parent gets money on a debit card. And what they do is they sign away their right to send their child to a public school, and then they get 90% of what would be spent on that child in a public school that they then can spend on educational materials. And there's been, as you might imagine, tremendous amount of fraud.
Right.
So what's happening on the federal level was the scheme that they put into the new tax code was there's been for quite a while something called 529 accounts. And they were a great idea. They allowed parents to save for their children's college education, and the money that accrued through interest would be tax-free, even when it was pulled out and used. So what this Congress did was this Congress added the ability of parents to be able to use this for K-12 private education.
Okay.
So in a sense, what it becomes is it's a voucher because all of the money that would be accrued on the interest that they should have to pay tax on, they don't have to pay tax on. So that means you and I are subsidizing this program. But to make it even worse is what had happened with the 529s was that many states, in order to incentivize parents to save for college, they had created their own tax deduction systems around the 529 accounts. New York is a state that has one, for example, so that a parent could, when they put the money into the 529s, not only did the interest grow tax-free, but they also got a deduction on their state income tax. That's the voucher. So now New York, a place that has always rejected vouchers, that has never wanted them, unless the state government goes in and changes the law and disallows the deduction for K to 12, that means that K to 12 private education, religious education, will now be paid for by all of the taxpayers in New York State. And what's problem too is that state governments are going, they're scratching their head because, you know what, this could just become a revolving door where parents put $10,000 into the account, right? They get their tax deduction. Right. Then they pull the money out to pay the tuition. So state revenues are going to go down.
Well, you look at that, and then I think about here, you know, say locally in Milwaukee. So I get a voucher, and now I can tax-free put money away. I'm double-dipping on the system to defund public education. And the question is people say, well, you know, people must be in favor of this because it keeps passing. And what we've seen here in Wisconsin is the fact is that most people don't realize how much of their tax money, if any, in fact, if they're paying real estate, go to the voucher program. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how we might get some transparency.
I mean, I really think people don't realize. I mean, if you take a look at some of the voucher programs in Wisconsin, now you're talking about, I'm looking at the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. It's per student $7,503 a year.
Mm-hmm.
The individual tax credit in Wisconsin, $4,932 a year. There's one, a special needs voucher program, $12,129 a year for students. I mean, this is money that would be used for the public school. What you see in many states, Indiana, for example, is whole districts going under, becoming insolvent because they have what's called backpack funding, where the money goes with the kid. So what happens is that money leaves the public school and it goes with the student, but you know, Tim, if your class size drops from 25 to 24,
yeah,
school district isn't saving any money when the child leaves.
Right.
But there's a heck of a lot of money that's going out the door. And it's so fascinating because when the public really understands it, that's why they hide it with all these cute names, right? Like scholarship this and opportunity that.
Right.
Because the public really is not in favor of vouchers. And when the public starts to find out, they rebel. There was a rebellion happening right now in the state of Arizona when the last session they expanded their education savings account program. And citizens got enough signatures on a ballot to put this as a referendum next November. And I have to tell you, the Koch brothers and Betsy DeVos are spending millions upon millions of dollars trying every way they can to not allow the citizens of Arizona to be able to vote on this issue.
You see, and that's the part where it makes you absolutely, you know, let's be honest, I mean, angry, because it's like you're spending millions of dollars so that people don't know, which even that should be enough news to make people go, wait a minute, you're spending that amount of money, so I don't know what in the world is it you're trying to hide from me. This stuff, it starts to really, if you spend too much time with it, you could actually get slightly depressed, which is why it's nice to know, though, that we have the Network for Public Education out there doing these things and working towards it. And I just wanted to hear in the last couple minutes, I mean, I've got... You're engaging in an investigative series with charter schools. You've got powerful voices in public education. Just a little bit about both of those two initiatives.
Yeah, we started last year a series that would run first in different pieces in the Washington Post answer sheet and then became a report on charter schools and charter school scandals, where I would go and spend time in a state and leave utterly depressed. California depressed the heck out of me, and you'd never think that, right, from a blue state. And then we're continuing the investigations. I just came back from Indiana, and I'm writing the second in the series, and we're expanding them now to not only include charter schools, but to include vouchers and voucher schools as well. We're also working with Opportunity Network, which is the C4 organization of the Schott Foundation, to do a national report card on privatization that grades states, depending upon the kind of laws they have around this and the extent that they've privatized schools. And then we have our Eight Powerful Voices series that's coming out. We've had two, where for in just a little snippet of of a few moments, we present a really powerful message about what's happening around issues that we care about with testing, school privatization, underfunding of public schools. School Choice Week is coming up January 21st, I believe it begins, and we are going to be out there that week publishing materials and releasing another film and making the case that, you know what, buyer beware. You know, they put this very friendly name of school choice on what they're doing, but the truth of the matter is, most parents in America, still their first choice is a good public school by 90%. And this rhetoric around school choice is really just, it's just a way to mask the privatization of public education, which the proponents of it refer to. Our public schools, our community public schools, governed by local school board members who are volunteers, well, they call them government schools. And that is, I think, just shows all of the hostility that is out there. This really is, Tim, I cannot impress upon listeners more. If we don't stop this and stop it now, we will lose public education in our generation, and we will not be able to put it back together again.
That's why we have the Network for Public Education, and that's why we have the Executive Director, Carol Burris, and that's why we have Busted Pencils. And Carol, what we like to say here, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you, Tim, for having me.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She is a lifelong Milwaukee resident who graduated from Milwaukee Public Schools. She has been an educator in Milwaukee for 17 years and a secretary on the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association Board for 5 of those years. She also tells me I have to say hello to her son Miles and her niece and nephew, Amaria and Marley, who are MPS students. Welcome to the show, Ingrid Walker Henry. That's the first request to say hello to people out there. So you get the prize for the first person to ask us to say hello to somebody.
You got to, you know, make sure to promote the children in your life.
Yeah, I'm going to say, you know, how much did that cost you any money to, you know, get him to say something? No. Okay.
It makes me the best auntie and the best mommy on the planet.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. Ingrid, so last week there was a teacher in Louisiana, Daishia Hargrave, who, upon learning that the superintendent was going to get a raise of $38,000 and the faculty weren't getting any raises for the past 10 years, in the process of a comment section during the meeting, made a comment about this and found herself arrested, thrown out of the board meeting, and a celebrity. In Milwaukee last week, this person named Ingrid also was asked to leave a school board meeting, but that didn't make national news. This isn't the same Ingrid we're talking to, is it?
It is. It is.
What did you do to make that board so angry?
Well, if you followed anything in Milwaukee, you know that educators and parents and community members have been on the forefront of fighting various legislative takeovers, and part of that is also ensuring that we have quality schools and that we're making sure that we really are fully supporting the public school system. And so one of the things that I was doing is going to speak to the board about their lease system, where they have been leasing schools at a rate lower than what they proposed about 8 years ago. But as I step up to the mic, I did point out, because they're usually sticklers for sticking to the topic. If you don't stick to the topic, they'll stop you, they'll redirect you, and finally they'll kind of say, you know what, we're going to be done tonight.
Okay.
Well, I pointed out to the committee member running it that, hey, you let the previous speakers speak to everything they wanted, and that wasn't really fair, so I'm going to go off topic for a little bit and then go back on. And he told me that, well, no, we're not going to do that right now. And I'm like, well, that's not fair, so I'm going to do it anyway.
Right.
And so I put in my 2 points about the fact that the purpose of charter schools was always supposed to be innovative. And the other thing that they always sold us on is that they're supposed to be able to do it better, cheaper. And that has not been the case. And then I proceeded to talk about the sweetheart lease deals that they were giving to these basically privateers. And they didn't like that I pointed out how one of those lease deals went bad when, which happens quite often, the school up and left in the middle of the year. And we're stuck holding the bag, $1 million, to continue to educate those children because you want to keep them in their school. But now we have to bring in actually highly qualified teachers and try to staff it, and but they cut me off.
Okay.
So that kind of upset me because these were valid points, and it really did stick to the actual topic at hand. But being a teacher, I kind of turned around and I said, here's the deal. I don't need a mic. I have teacher voice. And I just continued to talk to the auditorium.
And at that point, according to the video that the busted pencil top-notch researchers found, you were escorted out of the building.
I was escorted out, and I have to say that, you know, I'm okay. I had to call my mom right away, and because we were live-streaming it, Milwaukee Teachers Education Association was live-streaming it, and I didn't want her to think that, like, you know, that I was arrested, well, at this point, or anything. So, you know, I'm like, I'm fine, Mom. When you see the video, like, you know, I did have to leave the premises. I was going to listen to the rest in the hallway.
You know, buildings, believe it or not, school districts are leasing buildings to private charter companies. A private charter company up and leaves in the middle of the night. Kids are stuck there. The charter company is still receiving payments from Milwaukee Public Schools, the way I understand it, but yet there's no money available for those students who were kind of left high and dry. And so, Ingrid, you took it upon yourself, being an active member of the Milwaukee Teacher Education Association and an active member of the community, to point out that maybe this money should not be spent for people who aren't educating children.
That is basically it. And our in Milwaukee, our situation is definitely made more difficult with having the vouchers and then having UWM do charters and the city of Milwaukee holds charters. So if any of those close down, honestly, more than likely, Milwaukee Public Schools has to pick up the slack and educate children, which we're glad to do, but we don't have the funds
right. Because
and they've already been paid out.
And that was the other part that we need to make sure that people understand is that the money that was allocated for that student does not then follow that student back to where they're going to go. And so here we're operating, you know, at a deficit. And so, you know, out of order or not, but, you know, Daisha Hargrave has been out talking about the fact, though, that, you know, she herself wasn't out of order either in Louisiana, neither were you. But the reality is that there needs to be more push to have a teacher voice like yours to be speaking up for the students. Do you see that as your job?
I do. So what we have found out since Act 10 is that there are a lot of laws being made and educators aren't in the room. So in that type of environment and knowing that people are doing things that aren't best for the students that we work with, I can't see it as anything other than our job to speak on behalf of. We went into this profession. I can't tell you any teacher that I know that went in saying, hey, I'm going to get rich. That's not what happened. We went in because we love working with children and we love making that difference in our communities and in the world. And when we see things wrong, we have to speak up.
Well, and so how is it? I mean, does the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, how does that play in empowering you as a teacher to have that voice?
Oh, gosh, it definitely empowers me. This union is another part of my family. These are my sisters and brothers. We are working together every day. We're advocating. We're at school boards. We're together, and it's a collective voice. We're doing this together. What happens, I think, is that people, you try to make a difference by yourself, and sometimes you can, but if you can't, then you get a little discouraged and you maybe don't do it, but I don't, because I have this group and we're all working towards bettering lives of the children of Milwaukee. So, you know, without my union and feeling like I had people to support me, I wouldn't be vocal. I don't think I could do that, because it's not easy and it's sometimes a scary place to be in. But then you remember that this isn't for me. I am doing it for others, and it gives me that strength.
That's it. So, again, another pitch for, you know, a strong union, Milwaukee Teacher Education Association, badass teacher Ingrid Henry out there speaking up for the teachers. And, in fact, on January 27th, if you happen to be in the Milwaukee area and want to go to the Cactus Club and people want to give more questions to you, Ingrid, you're going to be at the Cactus Club for Educators Amplified from noon to 3. Right now, though, I want to say, for being the activist and for being the voice of the children and speaking up and using your union power, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you.
Joining us this week to take on that famous Alfie Cohn question is badass teacher and book author Steven Singer. Steven, what are the schools our children deserve?
The schools our children deserve are the schools that individualize their learning and do not standardize their assessments. The schools that treat them as individuals and that let them be creative and that connect to their lives and that treat them as human beings and not cogs in the machine.
Now our salute to legendary historian Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zinn.
The challenge remains. On the other side are formidable forces, money, political power, the major media. On our side are the people of the world and a power greater than money or weapons, the truth.
My thanks to Carol Burris, Alfie Cohn, Ingrid Henry, and Steven Singer. Do you like the show? Then like the show on Facebook. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.